In a recent Thai opinion piece about the intersection of Canadian mining interests and the Honduran coup, an allegation was made and then retracted that Export Development Canada was responsible for billions of dollars of pension funds going to Canadian mining companies abroad. A representative of EDC rebutted that point, but it's still anything but clear exactly how Canadian policy, private investment, and development agencies relate to Canadian registered mining around the world. On the other hand, it does seem to be clear that Canadian mining corporations operating in developing countries are sometimes creating conflict. The Thai has previously reported on such in Guatemala and Ecuador. On August 11th, I sat down with Tamara Herman, a Victoria-based researcher and activist who has spent months in the Mexican state of San Luis Potosí investigating social conflict around a particular Canadian mining operation there. When I spoke with her, she had just gotten back from a short return visit where she revisited the mine site and participated in a sit-in at the Canadian Embassy in Mexico City. I wanted to know what she's learned about how the Canadian government interacts with foreign operating companies generally, but first I asked her about that mine in Mexico.
It started actually with a corporation, a Canadian corporation named Metallica Resources Incorporated. And Metallica bought concessions back in 1995 to begin mining in the historic village of Cerro de San Pedro. And Metallica went through a couple of different partners at one point, but it maintained sole ownership for the most part over the project until last year when it merged with two other Canadian junior mining corporations based in British Columbia to become New Gold Incorporated.
Now, that's a lot of Canadian mining organizations. Is that common that a lot of the mining is done specifically by Canadian companies?
Well, much more than half of the global capital in mining is from Canadian corporations. And in Mexico alone, it's been calculated by the Secretary of the Economy that over 70% of mining concessions are held by Canadian corporations right now. So Canada is a huge global player in mining.
We're just specialized in mining around the world.
It's not a fluke. There's conditions that are put in place by the Canadian government to encourage corporations to register in Canada.
What does it mean for a company to be a Canadian mining company then? So does it necessarily mean that if I went to downtown Vancouver, I could find their offices? Or does it mean that it's Canadian personnel on the ground there? Or what?
It just means that it's registered in Canada as a Canadian corporation. And I guess the corporation would pay a certain amount of taxes. It would be subject to Canadian rules and regulations insofar as investment is concerned. But that's about it. For example, if we go back to Metallica Resources, Metallica Resources' office was actually located in Colorado, but it was registered on the Toronto Stock Exchange as a Canadian corporation. Metallica Resources did come on a yearly basis to Canada, to Toronto, to hold its shareholders meeting. But if you wanted to go and knock on the CEO's door, you'd have to take a plane down to Boulder.
No kidding. But just because of the legal constraints, I had to come up here for the shareholder meeting.
Mm-hmm. And a lot of their investors were Canadian as well.
What do you think are the conditions that the Canadian government sets such that a company that's in Boulder would choose to register in Canada instead of Boulder?
The big picture is that the Canadian government is very supportive of corporations that are investing in resource extraction overseas, and the support can be diplomatic. The Canadian embassy has been known to step in and lend a hand and just kind of make sure that Canadian corporations are getting very favorable treatment from authorities in the countries that they're operating in. So there's definitely diplomatic support. There's financial support as well, sometimes through the Canadian International Development Agency, sometimes in the form of risk assessment or other kind of packages of financial support from Export Development Canada, which is an export credit agency that's publicly owned. And as well, there's financial support in specific programs and projects that mining companies can operate on the side. So for instance, some corporations will say, well, actually, we're really contributing to the community that we're operating in. We have a school set up and the school will have obtained development funding from the Canadian International Development Agency.
Tamara Herman points to a complicated array of government entities. The Canadian Embassy, the Canadian International Development Agency, and yes, Export Development Canada. She says collectively they facilitate the mine's ability to operate and also the development programs that the mine implements to improve its standing with affected communities. I asked her how the people of the area had responded to that gathering of forces.
Well, the mine itself, when Metallica bought its concession in 1995, Cerro de San Pedro had been pretty much rejected and abandoned by the government after the last mine closed its doors in 1948.
What kind of a landscape is there? What is it, hill country or plains?
It's desert mountain, and the interesting thing about it, and something that's very important in kind of the particular case, is that the mine is located in the mountains just overlooking the Valley of San Luis. And in the Valley of San Luis, there's agricultural lands, kind of a whole band, or as they call it, a margin of agricultural lands, and then a city of 1.5 million people, which is also called San Luis Potosí. So the mine itself is actually only 8 kilometers. The center of the open pit is 8 kilometers from the city limit and 20 kilometers from the downtown location. And so when the mining company came in, it found this town in the mountains that was very poor. It's a desert environment. People farm, but there's not really that much farming you can do, right? And so the corporation began to put kind of the wheels in motion and start moving towards this mine. And it was quite surprised, I think, to find that people in the village were not exactly enthusiastic about the prospects of an open pit gold and silver mine. But the mine worked very hard to secure the support of villagers in the surrounding area, whereas the city of 1.5 million was the site of a very large resistance movement. And the city, the people in the city have been arguing that Cerro de San Pedro, which had been accorded special status because of its importance in terms of the region's aquifers, was actually the zone of impact of the mine was much greater than the village itself. The city itself and the agricultural fields between the mine and the city were all dependent on the water from the mine. And the mine is using massive cyanide leaching pads to extract the gold from the ore that's pulled out of the mountain. So what you get is a situation where in the mountains overlooking a big city, there's a mine, there's a risk of cyanide contamination, there's a huge degree of water consumption in a very arid area where people are already worried about water supplies, let alone water supplies in 10 years. Mm-hmm. And then you get the agricultural lands. And most of the people in San Luis, you know, eat local vegetables that come from that region. And then there's slums, and then there's the city. So you do, in the end, there's much more than 300 people that are affected by the mine. And this has been kind of the site of a lot of struggle and a battle in Cerro de San Pedro. I mean, the case has gone to the courts. They've been fighting in courts since 2000. And just recently, a court case was won by the opponents of the mine. And the mine lost its environmental permit, but it's operating anyways.
Western Canadians might be familiar with the uncomfortable process of balancing anticipated diffuse environmental dangers against the economic benefits of extraction sites. In San Luis Potosí, however, the community groups organizing against the risks would appear to be winning, at least in a legal sense.
You said that they lost their environmental permit, but they're still operating. How is that possible?
I think if you went down to Mexico and talked to the environmental organization that brought the company to court and said, how is that possible? They would say corruption and impunity. And actually, when I was in Mexico 2 weeks ago, the environmental organization went and filed a criminal suit against the magistrates that had ruled against the environmental permit awarded to the mining corporation. And the question, the heart of the matter in the criminal suit was, why is it that a ruling such as this that cancels an environmental permit can be issued and that the courts refuse to take any action to implement it when obviously it hasn't been implemented?
They hadn't heard an answer back. Nor did the Canadian ambassador have any message for Tamara Herman and the other people who recently held a sit-in at the Canadian embassy in Mexico City. Tamara told me that the Canadian government had established a series of extractive industries roundtables in various Canadian cities, but then didn't implement any of the recommendations from them. So I had a question.
Maybe it's hard to speculate on this, but why do you think that the federal government of Canada would be so interested in supporting mines, many of which are not strictly Canadian to begin with. Where's the benefit to the administration to a company like New Gold, based out of Colorado, profiting from operations in Mexico?
Canadian investors invest in the mine. I think that's the very simple answer. The Canadian pension, it can be private investors sometimes. I mean, if you look at a who's who of boards of directors and, you know, upper level civil servants, there's all sorts of interconnections between people making regulations and high ranking miners and investors and so on. But there's also the Canadian pension plan, which invests in a lot of these mines. You know, when the Export Development Corporation offers insurance, it's making money. The World Bank, Canada contributes to the World Bank. The World Bank provides insurance to the mining companies, and in turn, the World Bank invests in the companies as well. So the money comes back.
There are stories of Canadian mines succumbing to pressure and pulling out, only to have the mine site reactivated by companies from countries like China. With the support of the still enthusiastic local government and dubious environmental and human rights outcomes for locals, my final question for Tamara was to ask what she thought about that.
What you just said is the argument that I've heard again and again and again from mining corporations. You know, we have better standards than the Chinese. It's either us or them, and it might as well be us. We have better environmental standards. But I think in the end, what we have to recognize is that our taxpayers' money goes into supporting these companies. We're supporting these companies often inadvertently through the Canadian Embassy, through the Canadian-owned Export Development Corporation, through CETA. And I think the question is whether or not we actually want to be endorsing and paying the bill for these corporations. And I mean, sure, you can always argue that somebody else will step in and take over. And I think that for me, that's not a reason to endorse the type of destruction and the type of repression and the type of, you know, often blatant militarization that Canadian corporations have inflicted on communities throughout the world.
Mining researcher Tamara Herman isn't happy with Canada's standards being affected by the threat of companies from developing nations. But what about a case where the industry of an emergent power steps in to become the first in a region that Western nations have neglected? Last November, I interviewed Howard French, a former resident of both China and Africa, and who, amongst many other things, has written a book about China in Africa. As I was listing his accomplishments, we both suddenly got bored of it. We are lucky to have in the studio today Howard French. He joined the New York Times in 1986, worked as a metropolitan reporter for 3 years, and from 1990 to 2008, reported for the Times as bureau chief for Central America and the Caribbean. You know what? I'm going to skip a lot of this because it's a long resume.
Be my guest.
You have done a great many things.
I've been around.
Yeah. Some of the highlights are you lived in Shanghai for
5 years.
5 years.
Mm-hmm.
You wrote the book, A Continent for the Taking, The Tragedy and Hope of Africa, and also recipient of the Grantham Prize for Environmental Reporting.
Correct.
Well, congratulations on that, sir. Talking sensibly about a country as surprising as China, operating in a continent as diverse as Africa, is a challenge. But here's what Howard French saw as the basic condition.
There's a tension here. Almost all African countries have survived a very terrible legacy of colonialism, where infrastructure development was, in almost every case, highly inadequate and skewed toward the needs of the colonial power. Then, most African countries have, since the end of colonialism, roughly speaking, for most countries since 1960, there's been very little additional development. Most African countries have been very badly misruled. The revenues of the state have very seldom been invested in the improvement or the extension or even the maintenance of existing infrastructure. So the tension that exists is China coming willing to finance giant projects, willing to pay cash on the barrel for African raw materials, willing in many cases to obtain raw materials in exchange for big projects, for dams, for highways, for railways, for other sorts of infrastructure projects, meets an African need for infrastructure that is so intense that environmental concerns tend to be at very far down on the ladder in terms of priorities when they're mentioned at all.
And how quickly has China stepped in to fill that vacuum?
China has been able to, in a very short order, to become a player who just within the space of the last 5 years has come to rival the United States in terms of economic influence, trade, and increasingly in terms of political and policy sorts of influences as well.
Given that, you've got to wonder just how much worse might Chinese companies behave than Western ones would have. Howard French wouldn't let me get away with setting up a good guys versus bad guys scenario. He was adamant that Western companies in Africa have been responsible for some atrocious and usually unreported environmental and social infractions. But he did have this to say about Chinese newcomers.
The difference between the Western company and the Chinese company is that the Western company is more susceptible when it exists to public pressure, to what the press might write about it, whether it's the international press or the press in the particular African country that's concerned, and what its shareholders might say about something. There are various levers that exist in theory with regard to the behavior of Western companies in a context like an African country or an African business deal that you can't say quite the same thing for its Chinese counterpart.
It sounds like things are ambiguous. Like it's in an unresolved state right now. We don't know what's coming down the pike. Mm-hmm. Lay out for me the bad and the good scenario, one where we talk about infrastructure in Africa and you're talking about infrastructure coming to Africa, and then lay out for me the scenario of this involvement being a negative thing. What do those two things look like?
The upside could be a country like Zambia, where Chinese presence has begun to be big and where it has provoked a lot of attention domestically. Zambia is a democratic country. There's a fairly vigorous proto-civil society in Zambia, and people are excited about both the upside and the downside, potentially, of the Chinese involvement in their country. I think in a situation like that, a country like Zambia stands potentially to gain a lot from the Chinese presence because it has an active civil society, an active press, an active opposition politics. It has the potential for reining in the worst excesses or avoiding the worst excesses of Chinese involvement. The worst case scenario is a lot, and I could name a few other countries that I would put in a relatively democratic camp together with Zambia.
Throw me a couple of names. I'm interested in it.
Malawi, Mali, Tanzania, Mozambique, Senegal, Ghana. These are countries where you have a vigorous press, a civil society, intellectuals who are able to speak and to publish freely, and governments with relatively stable institutions that are beginning to develop a tradition of actually acting on behalf of well-articulated popular interests. In other countries, Nigeria, Congo, I could go on and on, Cameroon, Chad, these are countries with very weak institutions, with very high levels of corruption, where the population rate, as in almost all of the continent, growth rate is galloping. Nigeria, by 2050, will have more people than the United States. Africa, by 2050, will have nearly 2 billion people. So if in these countries where there are weak institutions, there is no civil society to speak of, where there are no safeguards, and where the deals are between China and the government, and the concerns of the people cannot be articulated and cannot be inserted into the equation, the possibility for disaster is immense.
Trajectory matters right now because we're talking about exponential growth.
Sure.
And so what direction you're going in from this starting point, whether things are going well or poorly, could be amplified enormously.
Here's the key. Africa is trading in non-renewable resources, whether you're talking about oil, whether you're talking about rainforest, whether you're talking about cobalt or copper in the ground. All of these things, once they're cut down or dug up, they won't be replaced. And if there has been no real development over the next 20 to 30 years while China is paying, admittedly, cash on the barrel, you know, there's nothing notably dishonest about what China is doing, whether you like it or not. If no development results from that, against a backdrop of doubling and even tripling populations, the nature of the tragedy to come is truly frightening.
Wow, we really should have ended on the good scenario. I always get those two backwards on this. But
right.
Everyone think back to the good scenario.
Right.
That
Malawi.
Was great. Yes. That's
Zambia.
Right. Yeah. Well, Howard French, thank you very much for coming into the show. It's been a great pleasure.
Thanks so much.
And thank you, internship application listener. I think there are several different podcast formats that can make good companions to the Taiyi's written journalism. Sit-down interviews with visitors like these can work well. It would be interesting to try doing primary audio journalism, and I'm especially interested in experimenting with interviewing Tai'i journalists as they're working on their pieces or after they're complete to add a different flavor of narrative to their written stories. Now, I appreciate your taking the time to listen to these clips, and I hope you get some fun applications and a great crop of interns this season. Take care.
Yeah, there comes a booming sound. It used to come from underground. Now it emanates from a kind of welfare state. Soul, yeah, baby of the soul.